We live in a world full of many messages, so that we may be more aware of them and of their effects on us. Let's be silent for a moment or two and try and get rid of cares and worries. Get in touch with ourselves. Would anybody like to share with the rest of us a joy or a concern this morning? Several hands.
Warren.
Lead on, I have.
Sorrows and joy. I'll give the sorrows. My sister in Maryland has Parkinson's disease, and it's gotten progressively worse, as it usually does. And then her husband, who was taking care of her, had a fall, two falls, and what amounts to a stroke. And she was taking care of herself quite well in their apartment until she, too, had a fall. So our Christmas was not exactly merry down there. They seem to be bouncing back now, but it's touch and go. And then the Sunday after Thanksgiving, our younger corgi died, probably of some congenital kidney disease, but we couldn't bring ourselves to announce that earlier.
And so the good news, which some of you already know, this was planned. We now have a thief in our house, a four-legged thief who has probably upset our garbage and raided everything in the house, taken possession of Warren's pillow on the bed so she can watch the birds, and her name is Drew, and she's a 4.5-year-old cardigan corgi, and a real treat.
Rachel Siegfried, who is at Oakwood, is celebrating her birthday this week, and so I have a card here I'll pass around if you'd like to sign that, and I'll get that to her.
It's a joy to have our daughter Julie with us today. Dave will be 75 on Monday, tomorrow. And Julie's here to help us cut the cake that we brought. We'd like you to all have a piece afterwards. And so.
You'd never guess he was 75, would you?
I'm 80. I'm a 13th. Okay. I have a joy and a concern. We're going to New Orleans on Tuesday and back the following Tuesday. We talked with Nevena last night, and she reported that there have been 12 murders in New Orleans this past week.
14, I think.
14? Oh, boy. So that's a concern.
they are concerned. They don't go out at night.
No. Also, she has sort of a part-time association with a fiber artist, but that is not full-time. She's been trying to borrow to get into the taxi driving in the meantime, has not been able to do that. So she is broke, hasn't paid her rent. Ah! So, you know, we'll pray to whom it may concern that things are better. And we're hoping to have a chat with her about moving to Seattle.
Well, I have both joys and concerns. My elder nephew, Peter, got married in October, and so I spent time with my brother's family, and we actually had some conversations for the first time in our adult lives. Also spent time with my parents, and my dad just turned 83. He's December 13th birthday also. He's becoming physically weaker and having trouble with mobility and cognition and memory. His sister, however, who's 92, is hard of hearing, uses a walker, but other than that, is just ducky. And I had a very nice visit with her out in Seattle. I've been playing tennis this last year after not playing for 35 years, so that's a joy, and there's probably other things too, but it's good to be back.
No one on that side?
Okay, two joys. My dog ate a cup of semi-sweet chocolate chips last night. So we induced vomiting, and she seems fine this morning. It was my fault that the chips were within access, within reach. The other joy is I'd like to welcome John and Mary France as new members. They signed the book today. They are right here.
Mine is a sorrow. I just came back from 2 weeks in California, and of course, like everybody, I've been thinking about George and how he was. I saw him the day before I left, and I talked to Ruth the day I came back, but my answering machine had a message telling me that my very dear friend Liz's husband, who was 87, had died suddenly, and so I've spent most of the time since I've been back phoning people for other people and, you know, doing kitty duty and stuff like that, and I feel very bad for Liz and Bob. They were married for 59 years and were really partners, and she helped him maintain his pride and sense of manhood up to the very end. She speaks wonderfully of hospice once again. She couldn't be happier, and I think you'd be pleased and maybe amused to know that our old friend John Brian Paprock comforted them with Greek Orthodox rites. They're Episcopalians. So he had a nice send-off from hospice, and it was nice to hear John Bryan's name again. We show up everywhere, don't we?
Well, thank you for the welcome. We've been coming long enough, we thought it was time we signed the book. At First Society, it took us about 40 years to be good participants, but not members. I have a joy about our youngest daughter. She has a beautiful voice that's never been trained, and she has been singing with a country group, country jam sessions down in Illinois. We had our first chance to hear her sing over at Milton at the Seventh-day Baptist Church last week, and her singing really did bring tears to our eyes. It's almost, but not quite, a sorrow that she is a very fundamentalist Christian, but we get along very well together, and I know she worries that we aren't saved, but we don't really worry much about her. Her music is very religiously oriented, so it was a pleasure.
I was delighted that our third daughter, Marion, came with her three children, no older dog because the dog had died, and her husband this year for Christmas. And they were rambunctious, they were lively, vivacious, everything. So it was wonderful having them, and it's wonderful they've gone. Our house is our own again. There are no more CDs and toys and candies and God knows what all over the place. And even the sheets are washed. So I'm ready for the new year.
I like this part of our service. And is this working? Yes. A month ago, there was an article in a magazine called Interconnections goes to Unitarian Universalist leaders. And there was an article by an ordained UU minister, I think from Georgia, expressing the opinion that joys and concerns, introduction of new members, announcements, should not really be part of a religious service, that it interrupted the flow, and so forth. I looked at that, and I thought to myself, you know, how nice it is. This is a good part of our service. And I wasn't the only one who felt that way. The most recent issue of Interconnections has a letter by Warren Hagstrom. Thank you, Warren, for... Anyone else?
No. You're not going to tell us what Warren's letter was?
Warren. I'll tell you if he won't. Okay. It simply said that he, too, thought that joys and concerns, introduction of new members, you know, announcements, were vital parts of the service. They gave us a sense of coming together so that it, so yeah, connection. So it wasn't just a presentation by a professional, the whole thing. Anyway, now there is we're going to hear from Andy Summers. Andy, would you like to sit or stand? You want a salsa? Well, that would be well.
Thank you. First of all, the song that was played by Marcia was a gift to me for my birthday. Has nothing at all to do with the program today. But thank you. It's also Dave's 75th birthday, so he beat me by a few years. And I just want to say, Dave, if you run into any kind of birthday cake anywhere, keep an eye on it. There are a lot of thieves around here. The propaganda. I came up with this thought about propaganda. You know, there are so many hidden messages that we're barraged with every day. We go to the movies, the old movies, we'd see people smoke, and there's so many hidden, you know, you see the Nike shoes and so on. They're all messages telling us to do something. Sometimes we recognize them, sometimes we don't. The latest one I see is the some rum, which has got a picture of some dashing guy and some beautiful girl in a bikini or something. And then underneath it says, drink responsibly. I have no idea what those two things mean together, but I would imagine that's what I would do if I drank the rum. But I thought we'd break up this program into three sections. One, we talk about kind of the arts. This is my favorite because I had a lot of fun. I went back to revisit old friends, and I learned a lot of things. That's the good thing about putting on a program. You learn things. And I learned a few things, especially about censorship. The second program will be on the 28th, and that'll be dealing with corporations and the press. And then the third one on February 4th, we'll have a gentleman coming in, Brian Standing, who will be talking about government and war. He has some clips from a documentary he's going to bring with him, too. So I had a fourth one in mind, but it would be on religion, which is perhaps the strongest source of propaganda. But I have a history of being irreverent, and I was a little afraid I'd get in trouble, because one of our themes here is to be totally tolerant of all religions and not to make fun of any, and I have a little trouble on the edge sometimes, and I go over the edge. So I left religion out, although it is a very important one, and we should give it some concern. Well, look at the word propaganda. It's a knee-jerk word for me. As soon as I hear the word propaganda, I react. It's bad, bad. It's Stalin, it's Hitler, and so on. People trying to convince us with false doctrines. But propaganda does not have to be bad. I mean, it can be good, or it can be neutral. We'll go to look up the word propaganda in the dictionary, and believe it or not, in like 1627, Pope Gregory, see, you can't get away from religion. Pope Gregory created a committee, an ad hoc committee called Propagation of the Faith. Committee is never adjourned, and it goes on forever. But that's where the word propaganda came from. The second definition in the dictionary seems to be delivering a message in order to influence people. And that's pretty much what it is. The way it has been used, of course, and abused, is, or used nicely, is kind of the topic of my talk. So I think it's kind of important that we recognize propaganda, ask ourselves, where does it come from? How does it affect us, and what can we do about it, if we have to do anything? first of all, we look at the word, you know, I hate to do this. When the philosophers tried to figure out the difference between men and animals, you know, they had too much time on their hands. And Aquinas came up. See, he can't stay away from this. He came up with the term risibility. I love that word. I had that since I was a boy, risibility. I went and looked it up, and I've never forgotten it. The ability to laugh. And that's what he thought was the difference between men and the animals. And Mike, before you get mad at me, when I say men, I mean generic men, men and women. But I think really the difference between men and animals is the ability to communicate. And from the very first caveman, man has been trying to communicate something, passing on information, which comes down to the topic of where do we get our information? And one of the main sources as a young person, of course, is the Bible. We're back to that again. And I want to know why, whenever I go into a hotel room and I go to open the drawer looking for Faulkner or Hemingway, why do I always find the Bible in there? I don't know where these Bibles come from. But they tell me, and when I go to review some of the books that I brought up, and I have him here, that, for instance, Uncle Tom's Cabin and All Quiet on the Western Front sold as many copies as the Bible. I just wonder, do people read the Bible, or do they just buy it? I mean, what? For instance, I go in, I open it up in the hotel, and there's a little note that says, "Lonely, read Mark, chapter 4, verse 3. So I turn to Mark, and a little note says, "Still lonely? Call Dolly, 256. Anyway, we have our parents, we have our teachers, we have... When I see the young people on TV today, and they're going to wreck, and they probably, you know, could be going to die, and they're being asked questions like, "What are you doing?" "Well, we've got to do the job." I hear this stuff. I say, "Where do they get this stuff? Where do they get this stuff?" I think it comes very early. You know, when I was a young kid in school, one of the songs we sang every day was a Protestant hymn called "Work for the Night is Coming." And it was a horrible song. You know, we would be 6-7 years old. "Work for the night is..." And it's a song about some guy who works until he drops dead in the field. You know, what a great message. I never wanted to work again for the rest of my... I became a lawyer. But the other thing is, in the public schools, I don't know how or why, or every kid has to get up and pledge allegiance. Why? You know, what is it? By the way, that was supposedly written by a socialist, which the conservatives do not want to hear about because they don't like socialists. But anyway, why did the kids have to pledge allegiance every day? You know, why do they have to wrap themselves in the flag? The third one is, why? When I go to a ball game or I'm about to watch a boxing match with two guys about to kill each other, why do we all stand up and sing the Star Spangled Banner? I mean, you know, what is this? Where does this come from? These are all hidden messages. These are messages we get very early. A couple of songs I heard that talk to us about this message about dying for our country. You know, frankly, I don't want to die for a country. I don't want to die for... I was born in Brooklyn. I don't want to die for Brooklyn, you know. I mean, just don't ask me to do that. But songs like the Patriot Game, an Irish song, in which the words come out, "The love of one's country is a terrible thing." Or the song we heard a couple weeks back, Waltzing Matilda, who talked about the horrors of war. Where do we get that? And yet, we don't get that message. We get the message of marching in the uniforms and the drums and John Philip Sousa and so on. So these are kind of scary things. Depending, too, on what the circumstances are. You know, during the Second World War, and that was called the Good War, you know, the First World War, I don't know what that was called, but that was the war we shouldn't have gotten into. There was a man, an Irish-American named George M. Cohan, and the Irish were not too welcomed in the our country when they first came over. There was signs up there, Irish need not apply, and so on. They were called a lot of different names, and so the great pressure was on them to assimilate and become Americans. George M. Cohan was one of the great patriots during the Second World War. And he wrote some great songs, songs that we all remember. You know, Yankee Doodle Dandy. He had Grand Old Flag. Give My Regards to Broadway. Over There, Over There. All these songs we remember. There's a statue for him in Broadway commemorating his gift to the theater. And, of course, Congress voted him some kind of a medal, and FDR gave him the medal. He was considered a super, super patriot. Now, back then, I thought that was great. I loved the play, George M., with Joel Gray, and I loved the songs. Today, I see people standing up there with little flag pens, wrapping themselves in the flag, and this promiscuous patriotism is not as friendly and as fun to me as it was back watching George M. Cohan. So, in fact, as soon as I see the pins, I get a little worried about what the guy is going to say to me. The artists, I'm not one to tell you too much about being an artist because I'm not one. I try to appreciate art. My wife is an artist. I don't really know the mind of an artist. An artist has this view of things that they want to tell people about. They want to communicate. Very few people, I think, have art for art's sake or do something and hide it and don't want anybody to see it. They want to communicate. There are some artists who have a message, have some kind of a desire to influence people. In other words, they want to give you propaganda. Picasso came up with this beautiful picture. They tell me that this was one of the most important pictures. It had to do with his reaction to the bombing of Guernica by the German Luftwaffe in 1937. And by the way, at the request of Franco. Franco wanted this little Basque town bombed to smithereens. And this was one of the first international, at least we know of, scenes where the military turned their weapons on non-combatants and wiped out the city. Picasso was so angry at Franco and his propaganda, trying to blame this bombing on the rebels, when it was actually the Spanish forces that did this. Anyway, he came up with this beautiful picture. You're welcome to come up and look at it. There's a lot of symbols in there. You have to really study it. There's dead baby, there's a woman, there's broken sword and so on. But this is a picture that moved a lot of people. And it made a lot of people, you know, the sad thing is that people see these things and you think, well, why don't they learn and never do the same mistakes? But it doesn't work that way. The artists have to keep on going. For instance, one of the plays that I enjoyed was Lysistrata, in which the women of this little town decided not to have sex anymore with the men because they were going to war and they wanted to stop war. And there is a society now that you find Lysistrata.com or something, and you can get to, they're a peace group, and they want to try and put pressure on the White House and other places to stop war. But if you want to go to the internet, you might be able to find that website. Picasso had an idea about what the artist was, and his idea that the artist must get angry, must come forth and say something. And so he He believed that art was more than just painting for art's sake. There was... Now, you know, I broke this up in the arts in a lot of categories, and I have to advise you, this is not the definitive work. In fact, if I wanted to, I would spend all my time on each category, and I can understand why people didn't get a PhD just studying one person, you know, one poet, one writer, one painter. So I'm not going to, when I just mentioned Picasso as a painter, I don't want to give you the idea that he was the only painter that you can consider. But a lot of his work was, in fact, propaganda. We go into writers. This is where I had a lot of fun. I went back to review a lot of the people that I met when I was in college. And one of the people that the priest in my college, St. John's, hated, was a man named Clifford Odets. And I had to laugh at the censorship that went on back then. We were going through the Red Scare type, and there was Joe McCarthy was running around. And earlier, in 1935, when Clifford Odets wrote a lot of his plays, there was something called the American Legion going around boycotting him and protesting. And he wrote, I mean, he was not subtle. You know, artists can be subtle, or they can hit you over the head with a piece of lumber. Odets was the kind of guy who hit you over the head with a piece of lumber. I mean, he talked about the battle between the working class and capitalism. And he was, in all respects, a communist, or he had communist influence or communist... In fact, in this play, they bring out the... In Waiting for Lefty, which was one of my favorites, at the end he says, it's war, working class, unite and fight. And of course the last part is, all yell out, strike, louder, strike, and again, strike, 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 strike. Well, I mean, there's no question what he's trying to tell you there. You don't have to be too stupid to understand that he is telling you to get busy and work on the difference between the working class man and the rich. Some of these books were subject to censorship. And the censorship, by the way, was not all government censorship, which is kind of interesting. Some censorship came from the people. And... George Orwell came. I love George Orwell. He had a lot of wonderful books. And he had a message. And he got mad at fascism and he got mad at communism. And he wanted to tell people about the terrible dangers. He wanted to tell people about the future and what to be aware of. When he wrote one of his books, Animal Farm, he was living in England. The book was shunned by the English people. They thought it was an affront. At that time, the theory was that the English people were friendly with Russia, and Russia was their friend, and they should not come out with any kind of criticism of Russia. Well, it's strange to have censorship like this, because this is self-imposed, and it was imposed by the liberals of the left. There was another book I got involved with a little earlier, The Committee, which is a book about Irish killings in the north of Ireland, and investigated, looked into the involvement of the British government. This book, you couldn't buy the book in England, Ireland, or Northern Ireland. Not because there was any government law. The booksellers wouldn't sell it. This was self-imposed censorship. When I go over to Ireland, I buy as many of these things as I can on the internet. They're out of print. I bring these. I smuggle them in, you know. Most guys smuggle. They bring, you know, cocaine or something. I bring books. With Lucy, yeah. Get a hold of Lucy before she gets to my hotel. But there can be self-imposed censorship. For instance, another one I can think of immediately is the Dixie Chicks. here's a bunch of people, homeless girls. I mean, they just sing country western music, and one of them had to say something bad about Bush, and the conservatives went crazy, and the Clear Channel took all their records off. And I don't know how many stations Clear Channel has. They wouldn't play the Dixie Chicks anymore. Some of the conservative disc jockeys started to burn her CDs and things. I mean, this is self-imposed censorship, but there was an awful lot of government influence in this. And we have to be aware of this. If we look, again, I said before that books and art can be subtle or it can be loud. One of the subtle books was a beautiful book, and this is one of them, they tell me, sold as many as the Bible in here and in Europe. And this was All Quiet on the Western Front. This one, by the way, was subject to censorship and by Hitler and Goebbels. They picketed. They wouldn't let the book be signed in Germany. They had book burning in Germany. Why? Because he made war look bad. I mean, this is strange. You know, there is censorship. Some of the other books, I say the soft touch. Beautiful one is To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. She talks about racism in the South. Subtly. I mean, she doesn't come out and say, this is what the book's about. This is the story of a little girl growing up and her father in a trial. Blah, blah. But it's a beautiful story, and you have to get the message. Now when you talk about blockbusters, where they hit you over the head, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. This is the book that Lincoln said when he met her. Ha-ha, he said, you're the lady who started this great war. And a lot of people read this book and became abolitionists right after reading the book. It was a book that was powerful. It showed, even though it was showed a lot of caricatures and so on, it brought out the secret elephant that was sitting in the living room, and it talked about it, and people began to understand what slavery was all about. Here's a little present I got from Leah Zeldin for my birthday, and she sent me a little poster. It says, make art, not war. I like this one. I got to leave these books up here for you to come and look at. And we left half of the books at home. That's why I say it was so much fun, because I started going through books and trying to say, hey, yeah, this one's on Gary Spence, yeah, he's talking about prejudice, yeah. And I stayed away from all the conservatives. I could have brought Ann Coulter in here. We could have had a lot of fun. But, or Limbaugh or any of those people. But what I found was good, what I considered good propaganda. In the movies, I mentioned the movies. I am an actor. I've been in quite a few plays. I recognize actors do not have personalities. We have no personalities. Alex Guinness said he had to look in the mirror every once in a while trying to figure who the hell he was. You see, in every play you take on the part of the person you're playing. And that becomes you. And so, you know, strange things happen. We had one, a B actor, Ronald Reagan, who went on to be governor. And nobody ever knew whether Reagan was talking about real life or a scene from a movie. I don't think he really made the entrance into reality too much. We had another man who really never did anything in his life. And yet, he became the symbol of everything. His name was John Wayne. My brother, God bless him, has a picture of John Wayne in his house. I mean, to the conservative people or the gun people, but John Wayne represents everything. Yet John Wayne really never did anything in his life, you know. yet he's a warrior, he's this, he's that, because he took on all the roles that he played in the movies. We had the same thing happen with, it's hard to look at Martin Sheen and not think of the West Wing, but some other actors, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'd look at him, I don't think anything. But I mean, these are guys, these are fellows who went on to use, Wayne didn't, but they used their positions, their actor, being an actor, to become something else. The, one of the writers that I tell you about, I didn't bring his book in, I have it, hitting people over the head with a piece of lumber. Upton Sinclair. What a writer. I mean, he let you have it. His book, The Jungle, was a vicious book in which it's kind of hard to understand how anybody eats sausage after reading that book. But he created such an uproar reading about the meatpacking industry and what happened and that Teddy Roosevelt appointed committees and they began the... They passed the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906 and the Meat Inspection Act in 1906. So these people did have great effect. They did have great messages. How are we doing on time? Mary says I talk too long. We got to be out of here by 11 or something. I'm going to finish it up with just two more things. We have an obligation, if we have a message, to get it out. And that's what I think propaganda is all about. There are so many people on the other side, or the side of unbridled capitalism, or the side that authoritarian side. They're pounding books out left and right. I don't know how they do this stuff, but they have no trouble writing books about their philosophy and what they believe in. We as liberals, or we of the left, or you, whoever, you know who you are. The Big Brother is watching you, and it's funny. One of the things Winston wrote in 1984, one of the first acts of rebellion. Because the big theme they had was Big Brother was watching you. Nobody knew who Big Brother was, but that was the theme. And he gets a little diary, and he says, he writes in very small writing, down with Big Brother, you know. So that has to really be, I'm suggesting that could be a great cause for all of us, down with Big Brother and get our message out. There was a woman named Marge Piercy who wrote a poem. And I didn't go into poets too much. There's so many poets we could go into. One of the group came out with a book right before the second Iraq war. They call themselves the Poets Against the War. And they got themselves disinvited to the White House. Laura Bush didn't think it proper to have these poets who are against the war coming to the White House. But there was a woman called Marge Piercy, P-I-E-R-C-Y. Who wrote The Low Road. And with your permission, what can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity. Blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll all over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob, a snake dancing file, and break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000 power and your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do. Again, and they said no. It starts when you say, we, and no, you know who you mean. And each day, you mean one more. There is a program called, oh, this is in the book called The Moon is Always Female. There is a program called WORT, W-O-R-T. And on Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, they have a program that starts, and they have clips from movies and so on. And they had one that hits me all the time. I love it. It has a voice saying, an idea can change the world, but someone first has to have an idea. They should finish up that statement with, someone has to do something about that idea. It's not enough just to have one. I wanted to just leave you with a statement by Picasso, if I can find it. Where is my book of Picasso? Oh, yeah, right. His preface is kind of moving. I can leave you with this. What do you think an artist is? An imbecile who only has eyes if he is a painter, or ears if he is a musician, or a lyre in every chamber of his heart if he is a poet, or even if he is a boxer, just his muscles? Far from it. At the same time, he is also a political being. Constantly aware of the heartbreaking, passionate, or delightful things that happen in the world, shaping himself completely in their image. How could it be possible to feel no interest in other people and with a cool indifference to detach yourself from the very life which they bring to you so abundantly? No, painting is not done to decorate apartments. It is an instrument of war. That is a powerful statement. The last thing at the end of a series on propaganda I would ask you to do is, when you hear the messages we are barraged with by corporations telling us to buy certain things, explaining to us that the worst thing in the world is ring around the collar, explaining all these little hidden things, ask yourself, as Cicero did, who profits by that statement? Where did it come from? What are they trying to tell us? And what should be my reaction? Thank you. I'll open it up for questions. I hope you're not too angry. Or now that I got you all angry... Yes.
I think you need to wait.
The microphone.
She's got
the I didn't see.
In the back.
Okay. Go ahead. Whoever has the mic.
Yes.
I find it very interesting listening to you, because you don't make a distinction that I've always made, and it may be a false distinction. I make a distinction between somebody who's telling me something, if they identify and say, okay, this is my bias, or this is my ideal, as opposed to somebody, and this is what I call propaganda, who tells me something as though it's the truth, when in fact they want to gull me into something. And so, in my mind, propaganda is a kind of a deliberate manipulation of somebody who's gullible, or an attempt to do that. Whereas we all have a point of view. And I don't mind people's points of view. What I mind is when they tell me that my teeth will rot and fall out of my head unless I use a certain toothpaste. I mean, so you see the distinction.
That's right. I agree with you. That's why Cicero said, who profits? And you should look to the point, what is the message? Why are they telling me what they are telling me? And I guess the last question is, what is the authority? By what authority? You know, when you tell people something, but what is your authority? And give us a chance to hear that.
So in my mind, there's a difference between Sinclair Upton. Where Upton Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair. That's why it's whatever. Election.
And his muckraking. Because he didn't make any bones about where he was coming from. He was trying to, like Dickens, show some really bad social conditions.
Right.
But if he were trying to pretend certain things in order to have me believe stuff, then I would resent it and call it propaganda.
Right. I agree with you that I didn't go into what I consider bad propaganda in the talk. I wanted to show people that there could be good propaganda, and I went into there's an awful lot out there. We have to hate. That was the implicit message. You always have to ask yourself, what are they trying to say when I look at this? Why am I laughing at this cartoon? And there's definitely, we'll get to media and corporations. I hope they get into a lot more about some of the stuff that's being fed to us on a daily basis or not being fed to us and how we can react and counteract. That's the propaganda coming from the media today. Yes.
Yeah, I think to keep in mind, particularly now, is that historically the longest lasting and most effective type of propaganda has always had to do with patriotism and war. And I remember being in school in Germany and taking Latin and learning at age 11 this verse that comes from a sort of a placard from one of the Peloponnesian Wars. And I don't remember whether it was 4th or 5th century, but it's that long ago. The verse, Dulce et decorum est pro patria morum, which means it is sweet and honorable to die for one's country. And this can be related to what you said earlier about what the young soldiers now that are suckered into the Iraq war, when you hear some of them, they will bring up this thing, I'm doing this for my country, but they have never learned to ask, what is it that we're doing for our country? And so this is a traditional thing, but I think it has a lot to do with human psychology. As I said, 4th and 5th century this thing was going on. And it does give people who do not have a strongly developed critical intellect, it gives them a feeling to be being part of a sort of a greater whole, just like a religion kind of thing. And so the word patriotism to me has always been like a red flag. It's been very, and it should be to all of us, you know, what is patriotism? What, for whom? What is it all about?
I don't know if you got this when you were a child. I did. And I can remember it to this day. It was a piece written by Edward Everett Hale. And he wrote about Philip Nolan, who was the man without a country. And there was a poem that they breathed through a man with soul so dead who never to himself has said. This was drummed into us when we were 7, 8, 9 years old. The love of one's country, you know.
Well, I remember talking back to my Latin teacher at age 11. I just couldn't get this idea. Yeah.
Well, as I said before, I don't know if I want to die for Brooklyn. I took a job one time in Albany, New York, and I had to swear an oath to New York State. And I said to myself, I wonder what the hell I'm doing. You know, if New Jersey attacks us, does that mean, you know? Well, and when I left New York, I was very guilty about leaving New York because I said, I'm violating my oath to New York State. But I mean, where do we get all that garbage? But go ahead.
I just recently read Orwell's Homage to Catalonia. He went to Spain as a reporter, but then found himself fighting in the war. And this book is really an eye-opener for him, to who saw that Russia was behind a lot of the horrible things that were happening in the Spanish Civil War. And so many people went to fight in that war for idealistic reasons, and he was the truth teller. That was, I think, the genesis of Animal Farm.
Yeah, he came back. He was wounded, and he left. He got kicked out of the country, I guess. And he came back, and that left a big impression. And Orwell wrote a lot of Down and Out in Paris. Was about his living the poor life in Paris. I mean, he had some great messages for us. Wonderful writer. You could reread him, and I would urge everybody to reread. You know, I just brought a sample of things here. I'll let you look at them. Reread them. They're all, I got so much more going back and finding what I call old friends. Hi.
Yeah. Interesting that you brought up the Dixie Chicks. I would have been surprised if you hadn't. You mentioned Clear Channel not playing their songs, and Clear Channel owns, it's between 1,200 and 1,300 radio stations across the country, so they are a major force in what people actually get to hear on the radio in terms of music. So that was a big thing for Clear Channel to not play their songs. And when they, you know, the Dixie Chicks kind of receded into the background for a couple of years, and then when they decided to, when they came out with their new album last year, what I read was that they basically did nothing, had nothing to do with the mainstream media, because they knew they would get this pressure, you know, to not play the songs, and so they you know, avoided releasing it to radio stations, and they sold it through Amazon and places like that, and they managed to have a pretty, you know, reasonable hit record without having that support from Clear Channel and those other stations. But
there are ways to fight back.
And the first single off their CD was called "Not Ready to Make Nice."
That's right. So. And they also did a documentary that was here in town, "Shut Up and Sing," which you can get through Netflix or Blockbuster or one of those programs. Yes.
I'm not sure how to phrase this. I'm uncomfortable that we're so very sure that we know what propaganda is and what the truth is. I think that there can be very clear instances where somebody is deliberately trying to mislead, but I think also people can be very sincere about their version of the truth as they see it in reality, and I think that we haven't talked about bias and how we're quick to judge information that comes to us based upon our bias. My husband, not I, we subscribe to a lot of magazines. He reads a lot of magazines with the different points of view from the left and the right and on the economy. And it's modified my position on things just by talking to him. I guess what I'm trying to say is that truth consists, sometimes the truth is only one point of view, sometimes it's multiple point of views. I guess I disagree with some of the examples that you gave this morning as propaganda, and I think that they're more, in my mind, a case of somebody exercising their freedom of speech and saying what their view of the world is, view of truth.
Again, it depends on how we define the word propaganda. There's a line in one of Odets's play, I don't know whether it was Golden Boy or one of those, in which somebody was talking to the father, and they said something about what is truth. And he said, "What is truth? Well, you can buy it for 3 cents," meaning that newspaper at that time was 3 cents. And that's how you could find out truth, in the newspaper. But it was kind of a cute phrase that stayed with me all these years. Yes, ma'am.
I have kind of on the same line of thought is that I kind of think of John Adams, who was kind of, from what I understand, from the Revolutionary time, he was more of a propagandist. He kind of embellished the story, such as the shot heard around the world, and how he was a real motivator for getting that to, or no, I'm sorry, Samuel Adams, his cousin, was a real motivator to get people to think, oh my gosh, look at the British attacked us innocent people, when the real story is they were antagonized, and how they were able to use that, Samuel Adams was able to use a lot of that viewpoint to motivate this revolt.
We're going to have a program on government and war. Okay. And I think the fellow will talk a little bit about William Randolph Hearst and the Spanish-American War, the Lusitania, Johnson and the Vietnam War, all these areas where certain things were thrown out to us to get us to react. Slogans, remember the Maine, you know, right down the line. A lot of them were phony. And really, you know, when the Mexican War, we had war with Mexico, they were hard to justify these things. War against the Indians, it's really hard to justify. So we came up with slogans to get us to be mad at a certain category of people. So we could go out and kill them. And you're right, and with the British, so much of history, to those who studied history, is revisionism. You know, it's taking a point of view and taking facts and allowing them to meet that point of view. I remember a Supreme Court justice once said that when he went to write an opinion, a lot depended on whether he started out with a question or an answer. And so think of that. As you start out with an answer, you spend the rest of your opinion justifying that answer. And a lot of history is that, that they find different ways. Or a lot of presidents or whoever the bully pulpit is finds a way of getting people to march around and start singing like with George M. Cohan, you know, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. So thank you. I think that in vaudeville they would get a hook and
Andy, thank you. I'm going to talk with you afterwards. I need to get some sources of authority for what you said. I have two baskets. They're beautiful. They're even more beautiful when there is folding money and checks inside them. We try to run this institution on love and concern, but money helps a little too. Eileen's going to play for us. Anybody here today for the first time, second time, and you haven't introduced yourself, please feel free to. And Mary's going to bring the mic back.
Hi, I'm Shannon Welsh. I'm in here town from Cambridge with my daughter Kira, and we're visiting today. Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Gail. I've been here once.
This is my second time, and I'm here because Shannon's here.
And she has a baby in her tummy.
Anyone else? Yes, a couple hands here.
Stand up.
Sure.
Okay. Hi, my name is Steven, and it's my first time, and Jennifer, my partner, brought me. I think she's been here a few times now. So I've heard a lot about you guys the last couple of weeks.
She fed you a lot of propaganda, did she? The good kind.
My name is, Joyce Harms. I recently relocated from Milwaukee, where I was a member of First Unitarian, over there for almost 13 years. So I'm looking for a new place to call home.
We hope you found it. Okay, it's time for that vital part of our service, says Warren. The announcements. Well, what we're going to do is, before we stand up and say something about what's happening at Prairie, please note that there are announcements on the third page of your order of service, and on the back page there are calendar items. So if it appears there, you really don't need to say it again. That said, now is the time for concise Prairie-related announcements.
Well, in a way, this is in the thing. Dan and Robin have been really good about putting my trip to the Art Institute, the fundraiser, on the calendar. But I haven't had all the information, and I have it now, and I'm about to put a poster, a flyer up on the bulletin board. I hope people will take a look at it. It's February 24th, and it is $62 for the Cezanne to Picasso exhibit.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm finance chair. We've just finished last year, so those of you that supported Prairie financially, I have a letter for you saying how much you gave for tax purposes. So if you come up to me and ask for your letter, I hope I'll be able to find it and give it to you.
I just wanted to let you know that 2 weeks from today, there will be a memorial service for my father presented here. He was not a Unitarian, but he was an atheist. He didn't go to church himself and gave me a book on Unitarianism and encouraged me to become one. So I thought that it was appropriate, and so you are all welcome. We plan to have a lunch first at about 10:45, and then the service itself, which will be brief, at 12:30, and you are welcome to come. There will be a nice display of a gentleman who died at age 98 and had a long and productive life, including 50 years of medical practice. And if you care to join us, four sisters and I will be here, and you're welcome. It's the 21st, January 21st, 2 weeks from today, and it's going to be sort of a potluck memorial. I'll maybe provide the traditional ham sandwiches, but if you'd like to bring something along with, that's fine too.
So it'll be right after the service, is that correct?
I'm Rebecca, and I'm the youth RE coordinator downstairs. I wanted to make an announcement on an event that's coming up for our RE kids, Wild Wintering, our annual overnight. That is going to be Saturday, January 20th to the 21st. I have a flyer outside on the board and permission slip. If you're not familiar with this event, it's an event for children of all ages at Prairie. Fun starts at 5 p.m., and we'll have food. The kids did vote just now that they wanted pizza, so we'll have pizza and some snacks. We'll have a lot of games. If weather permitting, we'll have games outside of the park. And then the kids will stay overnight, and they'll have some music, movies, and fun, and then we'll have breakfast provided for them the next day. So if you're interested in coming by, volunteering either as an overnight volunteer or somebody to help out with games, that would be great. And I have a sign-up sheet outside, too, as well.
Today at 2 o'clock, a group of us are going to see the movie The History Boys at Westgate, and there will be some discussion afterwards, so anyone is welcome to join us, and it's one way to get to know Prairie folks a little better, so I hope some newcomers join us. Westgate at 2 o'clock. Discussion afterwards.
There is an invitation then to stay afterwards to share some birthday cake with us. And I ask your indulgence to tell you an anecdote about birthday cakes. When we lived in Bangladesh, which was in the 1970s, there was a term of respect for, probably from the British times, was Sahib and Mem Sahib, except it was pronounced Saab in Bengal, where we lived. And the servants, of course, couldn't spell, so they spelled phonetically. So a guy, an American guy, had a birthday, and his wife told the cook, said, "Now, we want you to make a birthday cake and inscribe it." And so all his friends came, and they brought the birthday cake out, and it said, "Happy birthday, S.O.B."
And on that note, it says in your program, and here's a good illustration of why you shouldn't believe everything you read, that our closing hymn is going to be "This Land Is Your Land" on page 19 of the Prairie Songbook. That's not true. It's on page 51. Page 51. And if you don't have a Prairie Songbook around, but you do have Rise Up Singing, the colorful little book, it starts on page 5 with first three verses. Andy Summers. Mary's got a microphone, I think. Is she? What are you?
I'm reading this together. It's on 475 in the song.
475 in the
475?
In the hymn book.
This is the charter of the United Nations. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourges of war, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations, large and small, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, and for these ends to practice tolerance, and to live together in peace as good neighbors, to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, to ensure that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, to employ international machinery in the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all people, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims.
This morning.